the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. Brooke and I are going to have fun today. Opening up with Father's Day, we'll look at House Bill 370, the whole ICE controversy and sheriffs in North Carolina, what's going on with that. And Brooke and I will look at Reagan's iconic tear down this wall speech. It was just the anniversary of a few days ago, I believe, Brooke. And the pistol permit bill that's making its way through our General Assembly. And we may even have time to touch on Joe Biden, who's always a favorite. And we'll get into 80s nostalgia, too, one of the best decades of American history. We'll kind of delve into that as well. How's it going?
It's going good until you said 80s nostalgia, because I'm really inclined to think that you slipped up because you meant to say 90s.
I don't know. I'm a little more partial to the 80s. 90s was kind of weird because you had that, like the neon clothes and more fresh prints. But the 80s had Cheers and Dallas. They were bigger in the 80s. So I don't know, the 80s, it was the Reagan presidency. There was all these things. It was just kind of a bad hair, though, I would say, in general.
Bad hair, eye makeup.
Yeah, there was some bad eye makeup.
Major fashion faux pas.
And a lot of, like, men, especially British, because of the British rock and roll stuff that was big in the 80s, a lot of men dressing up as women. Probably, people don't realize this, but there was a lot of, when you think of, like, Boy George and some of these acts, there was a lot of men, more men dressing up like women in the 80s than probably now.
Oh, my. Well,
yeah, you know that from, like,
was
the rock.
Was Prince
and stuff.
A product of the 80s?
Yeah, he was very much popular in the 80s. He was in the 90s, too. But
I read a meme about Prince one time, and I thought it was so funny. It was Prince, the only man that can wear high heels and still steal your lady at the same time.
Really? I was never a big Prince fan, but.
Oh, I like some of his stuff.
I never got into him much, but I think he's probably very talented. Was talented, for sure. So no doubt about that.
Absolutely.
So let's kick it off with Father's Day. It's coming up in a few days. Those of you that'll be listening on Monday on the podcast, you'll be a day after. So you'll have your own thoughts as well, just from this recent Father's Day. But what kind of lessons did you learn from your dad, Brooke? What kind of things did he instill in your life that are a big part of your life today?
Yeah. So some of the lessons that I think of, and maybe a lot of kids do if you had a father in your home, was that they taught you a lot of practical lessons that just were kind of steeped in common sense. And when you're a teenager or a tween, sometimes common sense is a little hard to come by at first. And so I remember my dad, when I first started making money, and he drilled it into my brain to save your receipts. Like, that was one of the most important things, because back then, in the olden days, you couldn't track your purchases with your credit cards. And so that was one thing. My father would have envelopes and envelopes stuffed with receipts for each month. And so that was something I remember hearing all the time growing up, was save your receipts, save your receipts. So nowadays, I don't really have to save my receipts, but that's one of the practical things my dad taught me. However, the more important things that he taught me, I would say, revolve around not doing dumb things. Like,
yeah,
you know,
use
common sense. Look both ways when you're driving, when you're crossing the street. Don't overshare information. And don't let people push you around.
How do you not overshare information in this sort of social media craze phase we live in now?
Right. Well, that's probably one of the reasons my dad doesn't even have social media, because he believes in not oversharing information. Now, he was part of a special ops community, so obviously that was kind of ingrained into him anyways. But he's always been one of those people that is just filled with common sense and just, was able to give his daughters those many important lessons when it comes to how to carry yourself and conduct yourself while still having a good time. So he taught me a lot of great things, but I think the most important, and I'll let you share next, but is not to let people push you around. He was always one that he had daughters, and he just made sure that we were strong and that we held our heads up high, and that we, wouldn't wouldn't take crap from people.
Yeah, I will definitely testify to that because Brooke is hard to bully. Sometimes I try to bully her in the office and she will stick up for herself, and that's a credit to her father, I think.
Yep. I'll throat punch him sometimes if I have to.
I like to bully people a little bit, you know. And Brooke's always
keeps us on our toes.
Brooke takes it real well, but she also stands up for herself. She's not willing to get railroaded or anything. So lessons I learned from my dad. Of course, my dad was an Air Force pilot. So I think one of those lessons, and I know this is true for you, Brooke, is just service to something greater than yourself. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that I think that instilled into me a lot of things. My dad was gone a lot. That was hard at times growing up because he'd sit alert, even though sometimes he'd be on the base. He'd be in an underground bunker getting ready for, you know, nuclear Armageddon. But I think that was definitely one. I mean, I remember in his retirement ceremony in Mississippi, I thought that's one of the coolest things he did is he paid tribute to the 8th Air Force, the men that were pilots in the Army Air Corps and Air Force before him and what they had done in the, especially in the European war and the air war over Germany and how the costly nature of that air war was and just the 8th Air Force and what they did for America. And my dad taught me some things about back-talking women because anytime I back-talk my mom, I usually got a whooping. So that was one.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Way to go, Mr. Notes.
I think he taught me some good thing about finances too and just debt being a curse before the Dave Ramsey craze and things like that. He just, I think, did a good job of managing money, and that has been something that has carried over into my life to some degree, I think, at least. So that's been something that has been helpful to me. But, of course, I could go on all day on about things that, you know, he's helped me see and just the example that he's been in my life. And it's just great to have a good father. He's been very generous, too. I mean, he's given me money at times when, you know, certainly don't feel like I deserve it, but sometimes he'll offer up a gift or even to transfer some money into my account or something, and you're like, where'd this come from? But it's a great model of grace, and you know, we're not necessarily always deserving of those things, but my dad's been very generous. He's a much more generous person in many respects than probably I am, so it's good to learn those things.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like he set some amazing examples and continues to, so that's wonderful. So to all the dads out there, happy Father's Day. Thank you for what you do. Thank you for your involvement in our lives. And it means so much. And it actually does have an important impact on society. You know, in this day and age, sometimes that isn't applauded as loudly as it should. Or oftentimes there is this idea, this concept of toxic masculinity. But there are some amazing dads out there that, you know, just like when Mother's Day came around, I thought about all the ways that I could be a better mother, and maybe you feel that way as a father as well. But, you know, think about the things that you have done right and the ways in which you continue to improve and just even your presence and how valuable that is to your children. So thank you.
I think real quickly, too, this is almost revolutionary to say, Brooke, and I know you'll agree with me, but kids today, they need a mother and a dad.
Yeah,
you know, and it's like that's almost like politically incorrect to say nowadays, but it's so true. Just when you see raising your kids, that how much they need a mom and a dad, and certainly applaud all the single mothers and single fathers out there. Sometimes through no circumstance of their own, maybe a spouse died or something else happened, and credit to them for doing the best job that they are capable of doing. But to me, it's just very clear that. Especially young kids need a mom and dad in their life, and it's a powerful thing to shape them and to help them grow up to be a healthy contributing individual in our society that's morally grounded. It's funny to think that is controversial to some extent today, and I know it's been controversial for a while, but to me, after having kids, it's even more clear than, you know, just seeing it, believing it from a theoretical perspective.
Right. No, I think around 40% of children grow up in fatherless homes or single parent homes. Mm-hmm. And so it is a rather revolutionary idea, or it seems that way now. But there's so much to be said about it. And that's, I think you handled that with grace too, though, because there are sometimes where circumstances are way beyond our control and things didn't turn out the way we had hoped they would. And so we find ourselves single parenting. And so there's still hope in that. And there are some, you know, there are some amazing resources out there in communities and churches to help those parents. But again, there is this ideal. And I think it is a great thing for us to honor the dads and moms out there that are really working hard to make it happen.
Yep.
So Let's go ahead, and you actually wrote a few years ago on this tear down, Reagan's tear down this wall speech, and we have just hit the 32nd anniversary of that powerful speech that continues to just send reverberations through just when we talk about communism, that this speech kind of characterizes the American and the Western stance against it. Just share some thoughts on.
Yeah,
on
that. I mean, I was a child of the 80s, so I remember the Reagan presidency well. I was interested in politics. I was young. I was born in 1979, but I do remember the tail end of the Reagan presidency especially. And I do remember that moment, tear down this wall. It was a very iconic moment. There was a lot of controversy around it when he gave the speech. His chief speechwriter was a man named Tony Dolan. And the individual that actually wrote that speech, I think he works for several conservative organizations. He's on the Ricochet podcast from time to time. I've seen him speak at Hillsdale College a couple of times. His name is Peter Robinson. He's the one that wrote that speech. I think he was in his like late 20s when he actually wrote that speech. He was young. And he was working in the White House. When he pinned that wall, he wanted to put that line in that wall or in that speech, and Reagan liked it. He circled it when they were going through the editing process, because a lot of times these speechwriters would send it to the president. Reagan liked to be very involved in the speechwriting aspect. Some presidents don't like to be as involved, but he liked to be very involved because I think, you know, he was a performer to some degree. He had been an actor, and he had been governor for 2 terms, so he was involved in a lot of speechwriting. He wrote his own speeches when he did radio back in the day before he was president. But one of the things that came out about the speech is the State Department wanted that line taken out. So there was a battle between the speechwriters and the State Department. And Reagan finally, you know, he had the last word. So he said, "We're keeping it in there. I like the line." And so it became this very iconic line, but it was almost taken out because the State Department thought it would be combative and would, you know, make the Soviet Union, because there had been some progress and they wanted to be continued progress. So they thought it might antagonize the Soviets too much. And of course, it was a line that kind of gave Reagan a prophetic feel in terms of helping to bring an end to the Cold War as we knew it, at least back then. So it was a very powerful line. And the Germans, the West Germans and East Germans, they wanted that unification to take place. It had been so long that wall had been up. There had been a lot of just with the state police in East Germany, a lot of human rights abuses, a lot of arrests, any sort of things of opening up to the West was frowned upon. And so Reagan went right to the wall, went to the Brandenburg Gate and gave that speech. And it was an iconic moment. And so, you know, it just has kind of meant a lot, for freedom just in general.
Yes.
For people around the world. They kind of point to that speech as being important. And I think that's certainly certainly an iconic moment for that.
Right, because it transcends that particular time in history, right? It talks about just the political, or the walls put up by oppressive governments, mm-hmm. whether it's bureaucratic walls, regulatory ones. So, I mean, obviously there's that very tangible wall, and I actually lived in Germany during the time when it came down in 1989, and I remember my dad calling me into their bedroom mm-hmm. where the TV was and watching coverage of it. And it's just though that still, to think that line may have been even taken out because of this kind of kerfuffle between the State Department and his administration. I just think, what if we didn't have that sort of thing to point to? And I know it's just words, right? But really, words of a philosopher that I love, Peter Kreef, said words are houses that ideas live in. Yeah. And there is power in those sort of words. And that, so that sentence alone conveys this sort of defiance against overreaching government and totalitarianism. And so I think it's just powerful. So we wanted to take a moment and just reflect on that, because even in our own time, as people are maybe softening toward socialist sort of ideas or their idea of what socialism really is, it's important to be vigilant and understand really what's at stake, and to empower people to be able to tear down those walls. That's why Civitas Institute exists here in North Carolina. It's to remove the barriers to freedom so that all North Carolinians can enjoy a better life. And so I think that Reagan's speech really even hits home for us here at the Institute. So,
yep, absolutely.
Yep. But now I want to switch gears to something that's very important, and it is this fight of the century between Ray and I. And we already touched on it at the beginning, but I'm gonna bring it up again because I feel very confrontational about this. And it has to do with 90s versus 80s music, or incredible music versus lame music. And so Ray and I disagree on Twitter about this. And so I decided naturally to do a Twitter poll to see where people really landed on this so I could gauge public opinion. And the results were, in fact, that 90s music is better than 80s music. And so I feel like Ray owes me an apology.
How did you phrase your poll?
That's a minor detail that we don't need to look into right now, right? Okay, I'll read the phrasing in just a moment. I would like you to defend yourself. Why would 80s music be better than 90s music?
I think some of the biggest hits of the 80s, and I guess you're talking about popular music, because to me, like, country music in some degrees started to improve in the 80s from the 70s, where there was a, 80s movement started this new traditional movement again. It kind of grew somewhat in the 90s, but country music started to emerge and to appreciate tradition again in the 80s. But just in popular music in general, I think some of those iconic hits of the 80s are huge. I mean, when I think of, even though he's kind of a weirdo, well, not even kind of, probably a weirdo, or most likely, Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, I think that's the late 80s. That is a iconic, just such a well-written song.
Okay, I will give you that. That is a well-written song.
There's all kinds of examples, you know, whether it's like Toto's song Africa. There's all these like great songs. And I know that sometimes the synthesizer keyboards can be a little bit cheesy, but they're very iconic, more so than the 90s to me, which is more of a hodgepodge.
Is it iconic because you grew up during that time and you just feel?
Well, I grew up in the 90s.
I mean, so did I. We're not that far apart in age, but I have more kindredness and sweet feelings towards 90s music, for lack of a better term.
But what do you mean by 90s music, I guess?
Okay, so I mean hip hop, like Marky Mark, Puff Daddy, Tupac. I mean, R&B.
You like those guys?
Yes. Come on. Well, you know what? Ray just doesn't see. This is why we can't have a conversation on this. This is
of 90s music, I think of like Mariah Carey.
Oh, of course. I like her too.
Paula Abdul.
Okay, yeah. I like them too. Yeah. And then I even like some of the boy bands minus Hanson. But anyways,
like
here,
bands.
This is how I phrased my question. Help settle a dispute. Which decade produced better music? The lame 80s, the incredible 90s.
Right.
Like, what's to dispute
exactly
about that? So the poll results were that 47% voted for the lame 80s. Those 47% will hence be, like, forgotten in my mind. And then 53% voted for the
incredible
90s.
Looks like it's in the margin
90s.
Of error. What's the margin? I mean, you only
the margin of error is nothing. There is no error.
There's only 89 votes in the poll, so I feel like the margin of error would be really big, like 40%.
So anyways, lend us your thoughts. If you're watching on Facebook, sure, go ahead and comment on this, what your thoughts are on this music. Some people even wrote in the comments, you didn't put the 70s on here. So for the
70s had some pretty good music, I would say.
So they say. So anyways, there are some thoughts like that. So feel free to share your own thoughts with us. But I guess we should move on to more substantive things.
The music now, I don't get it all. So
I like the music now, too.
Do you?
Yes. My daughter.
I don't like what's good now.
Well, I like Taylor Swift, so her new Me song was great. Mm. I like Ed Sheeran, Sam Smith.
See,
you don't
know
these
people. No.
Yeah, see, Ray.
I've heard the name Ed Sheeran.
Ray's not in touch with the youths like I am. So.
I'm definitely not in touch with the youths, there's no doubt.
So let's talk about this ice showdown.
Okay.
This has been something that has dominated some of the North Carolina state headlines because it has to do with a House Bill 370 that was recently presented, which would effectively require that municipalities and cities such as Mecklenburg County's Sheriff's Department comply with federal ice detainment orders. So that means no sanctuary cities. That's really what it means.
Right.
So what are your thoughts on this bill?
I think it's a good bill, just from reading HB 370 and reading the text of the legislation, which I did earlier today. So I have no problem with it, Brooke. I think there's an important – I think most people of common sense agree this, that there needs to be cooperation between state, local, and federal law enforcement officials, especially when it comes to immigration. So I don't understand why it's that controversial for citizens to demand that, especially when you have – some illegals and a minority of illegals, let's be honest, it's not most illegals, but a minority of illegals that are taking advantage of not only coming here illegal, but then committing illegal acts after that, and they get caught up in the criminal justice system. So they need to be deported if they have no reason to be here. Certainly if they're committing crimes, they need to be deported. So I have no problem with the legislation. I think there it adds an enforcement mechanism in terms of creating greater cooperation between law enforcement entities. And I only see it as a good thing. I don't understand some of the controversy. I mean, I understand why people on the left want illegal immigration, but I don't understand why this bill would be controversial to the general public who are much more moderate.
Well, what do you make, though, of just, you know, state and local autonomy outside of federal law?
Sure.
So where do you draw the line? Why do they have to comply with a federal detainer request? I mean, if it's...
Well, I mean, the courts have kind of said that a lot of federal law trumps state laws to some degrees. But here's the thing. If we're talking about protecting North Carolinians, why wouldn't you work with the federal government? So, I mean, I don't see there's no due process. If there was some kind of constitutional right being violated, then I'd be all, you know, libertarian on this and all in. But it doesn't seem to me that there's any violation of due process. We talked about earlier before we came on air that there's a third party state official that has oversight, and that's why the sheriffs have signed on to this bill. So it's not just the federal government or ICE in itself calling the shots here, that there is a state official that has oversight. So to me, if it's about protecting North Carolinians, protecting their families, then I don't see this as a controversial measure. This is a measure to treat immigration as it should be treated in a serious manner. And if people are breaking immigration laws and then also committing crimes on top of that, they don't need to be here. They need to be deported.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that you make a great case for that. And so, unfortunately, though, the immigration problems and issues that we see are just they're so politicized, it's very polarizing, and there's just so much ineptitude at the federal level of government that has existed for a very, very long time. And so there's a lot of areas in which immigration needs to be reformed. And so I think sometimes what I hear on the other side of this is, you know, well, what about X? What about Y? What about Z? There's this whataboutism, like, if you're focusing on this, but you're not even doing anything to help make sure that families stay together at the border per federal regulations and things like that, you know, how can you spend time focusing on that if you're not going to do that?
Yeah.
And I think that it creates, even though it's not fun to have this tension, I believe both sides, if we have goodwill and it's not just about securing electorate and preserving these voting blocks that progressives think are going to help them in the next election, but if we can actually come together and realize that these people are human beings that deserve due process, but also that we need to protect American people from those that would harm them, I think we could come to the table and find some sort of traction and actually see some progress on immigration. But until that happens, it's just finger pointing and it's sad.
So here's a good quote from Tim Moore about the legislation. And I think it gets to the heart of just basic fairness and the rule of law. And he said that law-abiding citizens in North Carolina are subject to enforcement of state, federal law, and criminal illegal immigrants should be too. And I think that gets to the heart of it. I mean, if we're expected to follow state, local, and federal laws, then those that get caught in the system that aren't supposed to be here should be following federal law as well. So to me, it's just a common sense measure, and I know there's a lot of fake outrage. I'll call it fake outrage because I think it mostly is fake outrage of people on social media decrying this type of legislation. Or the big thing on the left is because they know it's popular. They argue it's not needed. It's not needed. Well, anybody who doesn't think we have a huge problem with illegal immigration here just is not paying attention to what's going on. So it is needed, and I'm glad to see that the legislature has acted.
Yeah, so that will be something that is going to, there's going to be a showdown. There's a lot of Democratic opposition to this, obviously, and so there will be many discussions and debates forthcoming on this, but we'll keep you guys posted. Another thing, though, that Ray and I wanted to talk about, especially because Ray has written on gun control in the past here at NC Civitas's website, nccivitas.org, but it is Senate Bill 90, which is a pistol permitting bill. So... You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think it's just a common sense measure. Of course, in North Carolina, a lot of red states, Brooke, have gotten rid of pistol permit process because there already is a federal background check when you buy a pistol, buy any long gun. There's federal background checks. And here, this is what has happened is basically, we're falling behind a lot of red states when it comes to measures like this because a lot of states, like I said, have scrapped the pistol permit system. It's really a relic from the Jim Crow era. A lot of these southern states created pistol permits. And then northern states, after the great migration of southern blacks moving up to the north, created their own pistol permit system because they wanted to keep black Americans or African Americans from having guns or having pistols. So that's the reason that a lot of these states created these pistol permits so that the sheriff would have the final say on who gets a pistol in the county. And so here's what's going on now is that there's been a bill put forward to basically say that you just need to get a pistol permit the one that you get, it's good for 5 years and you're able to buy as many pistols as you want. I think it's good legislation as a start, but ultimately I think it's a good idea to scrap this pistol permit system because of its racist past. And I think it's an issue. I mean, how you look at the Second Amendment, and if you believe in that firearms is an inherent right, I think it's an obstacle too large for many people in this country in terms of trying to control that system through the sheriff's office. I think people should have a right that, you know, if it's an inherent right, that maybe the sheriff's office is just too much of a prohibition for people. So it's a good start, and I would support the legislation, but I think North Carolina ultimately can do a little bit more here, or else it's, you know, continue to fall behind red states.
You know, another, because you brought up how this has its roots in Jim Crow era laws and how it was meant to discriminate against blacks in North Carolina, one other law that we've actually recently talked about and posted a video on our YouTube channel of is the literacy test that is inside the North Carolina Constitution. And that also was one that was intended to keep blacks from voting. And so I think that there are, you know, we can have these debates about the statues like Silent Sam and these monuments here across the state. And I think that those are fine debates to have, to be honest with you. I'm probably a little bit more progressive on my stance on those anyways, but we've got actual laws on the books, and not even on the books, just in our Constitution, that have these racist roots and are absolutely unnecessary. And so I think it's time that we really come to terms with those kind of laws if we're going to, at least to the same degree that we talk about some of these statues. So if you want to find out more about the literacy test requirement, you can go to our YouTube channel, which is just Civitas Institute. And Andy Jackson, our elections policy analyst, does a great job on a video there that was recorded by our comms fellow, Chris West. And so they put that together. So that's a great video. But yeah, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts on that. Ray, we're almost out of time, but let's talk really quickly. I've got a question for you about 2020.
Yep.
And I want to know, if you knew that a candidate would provide the cure for cancer, if only you voted for them for president, would you vote for them, even if you disagreed with all their other policies?
That's tough because, you know, are they pro-abortion? To me, that's like an important litmus test when you come to voting for somebody. I mean, if they don't have a pro-life worldview in mind, I'm apt to never vote for that person.
But they can't change the abortion laws anyways. Congress has to, right?
Yes, but I think, you know, sometimes having an important bully pulpit in the presidency that's pro-life. I mean, one of the things, even if you dislike Trump or something you don't like about Trump tweeting or this or that, you got to give Trump a lot of credit for just his pro-life views. Probably the most pro-life president in history, and that arguably at least includes Ronald Reagan, at least in terms of his actions. But back to your question, Brooke. Wow. I mean, I think I remember Trump hinting at this in his State of the Union or some address recently where he talked about there's going to be medical breakthroughs in the next decade. And I don't know if he specifically mentioned cancer, but I thought he mentioned some specific cancers. And so I don't know if Biden was just sort of...
Joe Biden was the one that promised this. I didn't give that context.
Yeah,
yet,
I spoiled your question a little bit. But I wonder if Biden was piggybacking a little bit on what Trump had kind of hinted at. But would I vote for that person? That's tough because it's going to make me look like a bad guy if I say no.
Well, I think, and so that's, you don't have to answer, but what I'm thinking is that when Biden was actually kind of strategically genius in doing that, I think, because...
Was he?
In a way, because then it's like, well, if you don't vote for me, then obviously you support cancer.
But people are too smart for that,
I would hope.
Yeah, I mean, are there a lot of Americans like, oh, man, I'm going to vote for Biden
because naturally he's going to cure cancer.
So he said that after two terms, or was it one term? Was he going to do it in one term?
Oh, I don't know. Years? If he was smart, it would be two terms. It would take two terms to cure it.
Given his age, he's hinted that he might only serve one term, too. He's kind of used... It's been a while since he's said that.
Do they ever really stop at one term, though?
No, there's only been a few presidents, I think, that I can think of. If there's any... I don't know if I can think of any. Maybe in the post-Civil War era, there was one or two that didn't decide to run again or just were sickly. But that's a good question. But yeah, I just don't think I could just. I mean, if it guaranteed a cure, then if that was my vote, then
yeah. So we'll,
because Biden's just gonna do it. I feel like he has the ability to cure cancer, right?
Naturally.
Yeah, it's like that. You know, it's like you see. It reminds me of that like kid in second grade, like, I'm gonna cure cancer. You know, that's like their dream, and it's like,
oh, right, but that's, I know, sweet. But you, that's, know what I mean? So mean.
Is it mean?
Yes, because that's a sweet little child saying that Biden is doing it for political like gain. So,
but I know, but it's almost like, you know, okay, kid, like, and hopefully we do cure cancer. I'm not.
Oh, I pray
that.
So.
Yes,
I pray so.
I pray.
I know you do too. But yeah. So, anyways, I just thought that was a fun question to ask you and see where you landed on that.
I have a question for you, Brooke.
Oh, okay.
If you knew that, if you could go back to 2000, and if you knew fully just how much Al Gore invented the internet, would you have voted for him?
My answer is absolutely yes. Of course I would have, because I owe my life to Al Gore now for inventing the internet.
There was a New York Times. He is one of the worst politicians in my mind, Democrat or Republican. There's a lot of bad Republicans out there too, but just a selfish person. It's kind of funny. He also divorced his wife after he did that weird kiss with her on stage. But in the creepy stuff, if you go and Google his massage stuff or whatever.
Oh my, I don't want to see it. I don't want to.
Anyways.
Know.
He's got to be...
Me eyes.
I don't know if it was the New York Times or Washington. Someone did a thing like, we need to apologize to Al Gore for the global warming stuff or whatever. Whatever's going on.
Okay.
Yeah, they were like... It just so bothered me because that guy's been so wrong about so much when it comes to climate change. I think it was the climate change. Because he wrote a book called Earth in the Balance, which was all about global warming, and all his predictions didn't come true. And now people are saying, oh, we've got to apologize, Dan. He didn't even write the book. I mean, the whole thing we've gone way off track, but
he's just a bad person. But anyways, you guys, we are out of time for this week. So thank you all so much for joining us. And go ahead and subscribe to us on iTunes or Google Play. And if you haven't yet rated us, please do so on iTunes. That really helps boost our content and make it more prioritized. Yeah. So thank you guys so much. And we hope you have a wonderful
week. Thank you.